He's just all over the place. They have a lot of pictures of him on the internet, I have to say. And it's called The Political Economist.
And he's got the invisible hand there on the
right. It's a key. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So it looks like George Washington.
They all look like different people to me.
Okay, I'm gonna read the themes on the next slide. These are the themes that go throughout the entire book. The primary importance of the money power. The nature of money purposely kept secret and confused. How a society defines money determines who controls the society. The battle over control of money has raged for millennia, public versus private. And from two of our students, Will Decker and Martin Dunn, the misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for the ordinary working people. And on the next slide, these are the parts of the first half of the chapter we're going to go over today. The first one's going to be an introduction, a summary, basically, of some of the ideas around the Bank of England. Number two, ideas rule economists as propagandists. Number three, economics degenerates from the scholastics. Number four, fostering a disdain for the lessons of history. Number five, Nicola Oresme's medieval mendacity. Number six, Walpole's disdain and Townsend's progressive theory of history. And that has a fair number of slides because I'm taking most of number six from one of Stephen's source books, which I love, which is here in front of me, The Two Nations by Christopher Hollis, who's an English author. And then we're going to talk at the end, an introduction to Adam Smith and some of the ideas that the author Stephen analyzes. He falsifies the government's monetary role as minor. He obscures and degrades the concept of money. He regresses to gold and silver by weight. He avoids the quantity of money and his poor definitions. So that's what we're going to cover today. Next week we'll cover the last half of the chapter. Okay, so part one, introduction summary. Okay, so Will, why don't you do this slide?
Okay, just a sec. Let me get it out here.
Okay.
Dr. Jonathan Swift, quoted by Cantillon on the Bank, there has been brought in such a complication of knavery and cozenage, such a history of inequity, such a jargon of unintelligible terms to involve it in, as were never known in the age of our country of the world. There you go, Jonathan Swift, and then William is heard on the left, a group of bankers, many people, and then it looks like a bank on the right.
Yeah, the Bank of England.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So Jonathan Swift, who lived from 1667 to 1745, he was pretty right on what his reaction to of this bank that was formed.
And unintelligible.
Yeah. A mystery of iniquity.
Yeah.
He knew. Martin, why don't you do the next one?
Okay.
Just a second.
Can I just...
So, Martin, I think you were going to do the next one.
Yeah, okay. Stephen Zollinger, L10, 5. The magnitude of the evil that was finally institutionalized in the Bank of England by the Dutch, Jewish, and English moneylenders and the House of Orange has not been fully recognized in terms of the long-range problems and disharmonies set in motion against humanity and now even the planet. Over there, like, well, on the left, we've got World War One. Looks like we've got third world poverty, and it looks like we've got some unpleasant pollution over there on the bottom right.
Right. The different problems we have in today in the world, being driven by the debt money system, think of a lot. And of course, war, the banks fund the wars, as they always have, with their debt money. Okay, next, Don.
Next slide. Page 306 of The Lost Science of Money. Private money systems like the Bank of England unjustly concentrated the resources of society into a few private hands, crippling the possibility for government to function properly. This would lead to a growing contempt of government. Today, people say, we can't trust the government, when they should be saying, we must take back our government. And the cartoon below shows that Uncle Sam is broke, held down by debt. And there's war going on. They got their guns pulled out over here in the sand someplace.
Yes, lots of war. Lots of war. And
yeah.
Unfortunate. Yeah, and the austerity that we all, you know, people are talking about today. Okay. Anne, why don't you do the next one?
Did you call on me?
Yeah.
Here we go. The private monetary domination of society has stood on three or four crucial legs. One, control of the creation and regulation of money. That's the money power. Two, using warfare to build up an immense national debt, demoralizing people, crippling government. Three, harsh taxation on the populace. Four, absence of countervailing moral force to identify injustice and call for action against the corrupted monetary regime. And there we see President Wilson, and this looks like some protesters, the most taxed cities in America, and Mr. Kucinich.
The hero.
To reform the monetary system.
Yes. Right.
Peter, do you know Kucinich's role in monetary history?
Could you repeat that, please, Sue?
Do you know Dennis Kucinich and his role in monetary history?
No, I don't. No.
He was in Congress until 2012. And while he was in Congress, he put in a bill 2 years in a row, H.R. for House of Representatives, H.R. 2990. And in that bill, he defines changes in the current money system, current in the United States, the Federal Reserve System, in order to eliminate the private banks actually creating the money.
Introduction summary. The underlying primary source of the power, the wealth pumping money day and night, was usury, the structural misuse of society's money mechanism. It is the privilege to create and direct the flow of new credit money and to charge interest on loans of private money created in thin air. And then we've got a picture of signed to Wall Street, all the bank logos, and the octopus. I don't know what date that is.
That's...
It looks like, is that a reference to Andrew Jackson's comment about...
No, it's Aldrich, down at the bottom. The senator in the early 1900s.
Right.
The plan began, I think, in 1907, and he was key to the Federal Reserve law, which was passed in 1913.
Yeah, there was...
So it took a long time.
There was a man, he was actually, I think he was a lawyer here in the United States, when they were planning the Federal Reserve bill, and it was there was a lot of controversy about it. He wrote a book. He was very much against it. He saw what it would do. He wrote a book, and in it he had all these cartoons, and this is one of them.
Oh, yes. Oh, that looks interesting.
Yeah, and I have his, let's see. Yeah, here he is. I have his book. Alfred Crozier, C-R-O-Z-I-E-R. He, it's called U.S. Money versus Corporation Currency, the Aldrich Plan. And in it are all these wonderful cartoons and drawings. Very, very good book. I recommend it. Okay.
Right, got that.
Okay. Will, why don't you do the next one?
Okay. It transferred power from society to the money power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whether business was good or bad, whether crops were abundant or there was drought, whether the community was healthy or beset by plague. It transferred this wealth even though its beneficiaries normally did little or nothing useful for their fellow man, but systematically harmed the society to derive greater payments from it and to render it less capable of protecting itself from parasitical activities. And then you have on the left, you have a chart of people's consumption going up and wages going down. Consumption, the business being bigger, the people being less. Interest, and then interest flows to the banks. That's the reason for all those big buildings in New York City and London, those big buildings. The gap between the richness and the rest of us, between the very rich and the rich, is going. It's getting bigger, and you show, it's got the picture of all the 99%, and then the gap widens as it gets toward the top.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, I'm just noticing the picture on the left, right?
Yes.
Actually, that's a picture of what we call the real economy, you know, like the businesses. But what's even really the real economy is the financial economy. And that's also, all the interest from that is going to the banks. So when you think of the economy, not, you know, the real economy is sort of on the side, but all of the speculation in all of the different markets, you know, is generating also interest to the banks. Martin, do the next one.
Just a sec. I got to get a slide up here.
Let's see. They received the wealth of nations through conquest of their money systems. Few shots were fired and no formal surrender occurred to announce to the people that they and their prosperity were to be subject to this power. Over there on the left, we have other tasks of the European Central Bank and the Euro system. Over there on the left, we have 100 years of the Federal Reserve commemorating the centennial.
Yeah, I didn't put the Bank of England on there. I could have put the Bank of England, the Mother Bank. Mother Bank. So you can, this is, you know, it's... We've talked a little bit about the British and their economic warfare, right? They're counterfeiting the money of other states to destroy the society by destroying the money. And this is similar. You get control of their money system. Don, I think you're next.
Yes. Next slide. Yes. Awareness was limited to very few people. Forbes magazine founder Bertie Carl Forbes wrote 7 years later, "Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York on a private railroad car under cover of darkness, stealthily riding hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking onto an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such rigid secrecy that the names of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servants learn the identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret expedition in the history of American finance. I am not romancing. I am giving to the world, for the first time, the real story of how the famous Aldrich Currency Report, the foundation of our new currency system, was written. The utmost secrecy was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done." And here you see some of the key malefactors. Paul Warburg from the German Warburg Bank and the Bank in New York, Kuhn Lieb and Company in New York City. Frank Vanderlip in Citibank, which was owned by Rockefeller. Nelson Aldrich, a senator, and who married into the Rockefeller family, or his daughter did, I believe. I'm not sure.
Yes.
Benjamin Strong with Morgan. Well, the yes was to which topic?
Yeah, there's the Jekyll Island Hunt Club. The Jekyll Island Hunt Club. One of the people, one of the bankers who secretly went there, took his hunting rifle with him as a cover. Yeah, and Aldrich.
But the.
Guy.
There you go. What should I do? Yeah, she wants you to do slide 14.
Ideas rule.
Yeah.
Economists as propagandists. Over time, society is ruled by ideas. This new private monetary rule over mankind required a new theology that justified and sanctified the new world order. In the United States, political economy first was taught at the College of William and Mary, where in 1784, Smith's The Wealth of Nations was a required textbook.
Boy, they...
This new theology.
Okay, wait a minute.
Slide 15.
Yeah, I'm just going to make a point that this Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was published in 1776.
Yeah.
And 676. 8 years later, it's a required textbook in the United States.
Yeah, William and Mary.
William and Mary, the College of William and Mary, right.
This new theology justified the private money power, which shrouded its essentials in mystery. The political economists served as a propaganda apparatus to whitewash the monetary power structure. They put forward false ideas and smoke screens on the nature of money that helped entrench the bankers. Now we have Adam Smith from The Wealth of Nations saying, by the money price of goods, it is to be observed I understand always, the quality of pure gold or silver for which they are sold without any regard to denomination of the coin. Well, and here we have a photo of the Wealth of Nations.
The actual book.
And then we're at Ideas Rule, Economists as Propagandists. New economists have included a deep concern for economic justice in their work.
Okay, hold on there. Hold on. Stay at that slide. Okay. And tell us about the pictures, and then next we'll have Peter go. But Anne, tell us about these pictures.
I'm sorry?
Tell us about
what did you say?
Tell us about the pictures on slide 16.
Slide 16. Yeah.
Slide 16. Okay, we have a photo of children workers and child labor.
Go by. What
effect of this system? Big child labor system. We have some of it here. England was fraught with child labor, and we have an illustration from Fred Bernard of Dickens at work in a shoe blacking factory after his father had been sent to debtor's prison, published in the 1892 edition of Forster's Life of Dickens. And you can see these children were supposed to work 18-hour days and, you know, live on very little food and work in factories. And his father couldn't pay his debts, and he's in prison. And so this really happened, and we have Dickens to thank for many novels and magazine articles recounting the various ways in which this social injustice illustrated itself. And as we go into the Adam Smith Wealth of Nations chapter, end of the chapter, they talked about how even Dickens' work, as popular and impactful as it was, was wiped out by the economist propaganda.
By Adam Smith.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good, thank you. Peter, why don't you do the next one?
Is that number 18?
Yep.
Yeah.
Economics degenerates from the scholastics. The Catholic scholastics, 1100 to 1500 AD, church scholars, first moral economists, Thomas Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. Money is a medium in exchange and not terminus. Money is not an end in itself. A loan has no risk to the lender, therefore usury is unearned income. Political economists, 1700 plus AD, examine the nature of wealth and the laws, both natural and man-made, governing its production and distribution. John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873. Political economy, I'll go down to the bottom. The scholastics concentrated on the morality of economic activity, drawing conclusions from certain principles they held to be true. Political economists also stressed the theoretical approach, but did away with any morality of economic activities. Absolutely right.
Yep. Yeah, that's what we have today.
But he shouldn't be calling them political economists.
We're up to fostering a disdain for the lessons of history. Why don't you do the next one?
Yeah, I got to scroll up here. 20, page 20. Okay. H.S. Bothwell, 1908, preface to Andrea's History of the Bank of England, page whatever that is, X 12. Okay. It was not the absence of official records that left so many other chapters of English economic history to be felt. First dealt with by foreigners, the main cause is to be found in the anti-historical basis of the dominant school of English official economists. Most of them avowed disciples of David Ricardo. Their doctrinaire habits and their beliefs, they were in possession of a set of principles of universal application led them to frown on historical research as at best mere waste of time. Historical differences had no interest, and he relegated history to the antiquary. This, as we now see, is really the attitude of the quack.
Yep.
And there he is.
Quack. There he is. Then we're going on to Nicholas Oresme's Medieval Mendacity.
Okay.
Why don't you do the next one, number 22.
Nicholas Oresme's Medieval Mendacity. Oresme, counselor of King Charles V of France, supported the aristocracy in its reactions to the crown's debasement of the currency. Here was a Catholic precedent to the monetary trickery of the political economists. When Oresme wrote, the first phase of the Hundred Years' War between the Plantagenets and the Valois had been going 20 years. The French kings, in desperation, had resorted to an almost continuous series of debasements of their coinage in order to provide money to meet a succession of expensive emergencies. The results for landowners were catastrophic. Over there on the left, we have Nicholas Oresme, 1323 to 1382, sitting in a, looks like a very fine boat. And over there on the bottom right, we have the Battle of Crecy. France, 26th of August, 1346.
Right. So this is placing Oresme in history, what was going on at the point he wrote his thesis here. Don, do the next one.
Oresme, Medieval Mendacity. As early as the 14th century, that's the 1300s, some men, such as the treasurer general of the town of Navarre, understood who gained or who lost by certain monetary policies.
Okay.
Everywhere there are four sorts of men. The first are those who have rents. They want money of strong alloy. Second are those who engage in commerce. Trade is always poor except when money is in a middle state. The third sort of men are those who live from the work of their body. These would wish to have weak money. The fourth sort of money is desired by lords when they are at war and want to pay troops in feeble coin.
Right, so this, you know, how much gold and silver can you take out of the coinage and still use it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and do the next one.
Okay, slide 24. The scourge of debasement. Table 5, long-term changes in 12 major currencies from 1300 to 1500.
And this chart basically is from a source of Stevens, and it's showing you over the course of 200 years, from 1300 to 1500, which is the end of the Middle Ages, how much debasement of the coinage. So the societies at the bottom of the chart had very little debasement. As you go up the chart, the debasement gets more and more. Okay, so you can see England is at the very bottom of the chart, okay? And then going up, you go through Aragon, Aragon and Venice did not have very much either. Then you're going Bohemia, Hansa, Florence, Rome. They had a little bit more. And then France, Austria, Flanders, still more. And then finally you get to these two that just was off the charts, Cologne and Castile. So depending on where you're looking in European history, there was more or less debasement of the coinage. Okay, so Anne, now you can continue.
Okay. The general theory was that any king or prince may, of his own authority, by right or prerogative, freely alter the money current in his realm, regulate it at his will, and take whatever gain or profit may result. The cornerstone of Erasme's theory was that coinage belongs to the community, i.e. noble landlords, not to the prince. Therefore, the community, not the prince, might alter the coinage in emergencies. His views became a new orthodoxy in France and Europe for the next 2 years.
Centuries.
Yeah.
200
years.
Peter, do the next one.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Nicola Oresme's medieval mendacity. Oresme's argument is purely one-sided. For him, the only sort of good money was strong money. Because of these alternations, money rents, yearly rent, yearly pensions, leases, cesses, and the like cannot be well and justly assessed or valued as is well known. A closer look at Oresme's argument shows that as far as trade was concerned, he was only interested in the import trade, that is, in the supply of luxury goods to the land-owning classes. Even his arguments about trade are tinged with party interest. That's from Spofford, Money and Its Use in Medieval Europe.
And there's a picture of the luxury goods. Will, why don't you do the next one?
Okay. Well, Peter, are we saying goodbye to you?
Not until 9:45 my time. That's okay. 40 couple of minutes.
Okay. The kings of England, who had a tradition of relatively frequent direct taxation by parliamentary grant and of a continued revenue from the customs, particularly the wool customs, were in favored position compared with the French enemies. The English kings could mobilize a much greater portion of the wealth of their smaller kingdom without the recourse to this debasement. It was the early growth of an efficient system of lay subsidies that saved the English nobility the scourge of debasement. In France, the Netherlands, and Castile, the overwhelming expense of war, the rulers violent debasements, the economic effects were in general favorable for the payers of fixed dues and bad for the consuming classes in general. And then you have the House of Lords and House of Commons during King Charles I's reign, 1640 to 1642.
And of course it was the House of Commons that would pass the laws for taxation, right? They had the power of taxation. The power to create money was still in the hands of the crown, right? Okay, so we're going on to Walpole's Disdain and Townsend Progressive Theory of History. Martin?
Okay. Walpole's Disdain and Townshend's Progressive Theory of History. Roger Walpole, Prime Minister from 1721 to 1742. Walpole ruled England for more than 20 years. The method by which he ruled was the method of frank bribery and blackmail. At least he spent the money that he made on building a house, on entertainment, on the pleasures of the country. He did not merely lend out again at usury, the profits of usury in a lunatic's lust for accumulation. Whatever he wants, he was at least a man, not a bad man.
I love that.
Right. The bank hath benefit of the interest of all the monies which it creates out of nothing, explained Patterson, which again was fair enough and frank enough, but would not perhaps a little something about service to the community have been a trifle more discreet? If the poor heard too much talk like that, then the whole regime must collapse. Christopher Hollis, Two Nations, page 35 to 36. And he was clearly a very blunt individual.
Say that again, Martin.
He was a very blunt individual.
Blunt.
Oh, yes. Very much. Very much. This part of the, this section is based on Christopher Hollis's book. Don, do the next one.
Wait a minute. Where are we at?
29.
Yeah.
Walpole's disdain and Townshend's progressive theory of history. Charles Townsend, Walpole's brother-in-law, was born in 1674 and died in 1738. It was Townshend who grasped perhaps more clearly than any other of the Whigs of the early 18th century that an aristocracy, if it is to retain its privileges, must make some pretense of earning them by some service to its country, says Hollis on page 37. It was not convenient, as Townshend and his colleagues saw, that the methods by which the gentlemen of England had become so should be widely known. Therefore, attention must be diverted from the details of that rise, and an official version must be put out to occupy the minds of those whose interest in history it was not possible wholly to suppress. Holly. So they had a public relations system going.
Oh, yes.
To take care of.
Very, very much. Next, Anne.
Okay. Gilbert Burnett, English bishop and historian, 1643 to 1715. Burnett now traveled, finally settling in Holland at The Hague, where he won from the Princess of Orange a confidence which proved enduring. He rendered a signal service by inducing the princess to offer to leave the whole political power in her husband's hands in the event of their succession to the English crown. In Holland, he married a Dutch heiress. He returned to England with William and Mary and drew up the English text of their declaration. As the war dragged on, Burnett grew to be seriously alarmed at the unpopularity of the debt system among the gentry who had to pay the taxes to meet its charges. A Whig history must be written to show what are the methods bad princes have taken to enslave us and by what conduct we have been preserved. That's Hollis.
Now, notice he's one of the people who came over with William of Orange. Right? He's one of the ones around the crown that 6 years later gave us the Bank of England charter. Right? So he's right in there. He married a Dutch heiress. Peter, do the next one.
Yes, I'll just do the last one and then I'll have to leave.
Okay.
Walpole's disdain and Townsend's progressive theory of history. Quote from Hollis. So the Whig history was written. The important task was to capture the educational machine. In 1724, Townsend and Gibson, Bishop of London, arranged for 24 persons who are fellows of colleges in the two universities, 12 from Oxford and 12 from Cambridge, to preach a sermon each at Whitehall, to receive the considerable emolument of £30, and none must hope for a share of this bounty but they who are staunch Whigs and openly declared them must be so. But there was needed, thought Townsend, some further encouragement.
Yeah, and these are the two Tory, you know, strongholds of Tory education at that point, you know, Oxford and Cambridge. And Townsend and Walpole are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, how come they're not liking our system of taxation and, you know, paying the interest on this government debt. So let's go in and preach to them, right? Let's tell them why they shouldn't mind being taxed. Peter, thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, and thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Peter. Bye.
Will, I think you're next.
Okay. Townsend wrote George the First. As your majesty knows, I have always had the gaining, university tutors owe to your majesty. Some things proper to this end. The foundation of a new professorship to teach the modern tongues and modern history. Hollis, page 38. Therefore, Crown appointed me and funded two royal professorships. The duties of professors were to deliver one lecture a term and to keep an eye on 20 scholars nominated by the dean to be taught gratis. And every year, a rested account of the progress made by each scholar to our principal secretary of the state. Hollis, page 39. Cambridge University's Royal Professor of Modern History, 1724. Oxford University, the Royal Professor of History, 1724. They were planting their ideas.
Yeah, and these scholars, their accounts would be sent to the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy. Martin.
Okay. Walpole's disdain and Townshend's progressive theory of history. What was the history which these endowed teachers taught? It was the progressive theory of history, a theory hitherto unknown, a theory soon, as a result of their activities, accepted uncritically, a theory created in the first place quite cynically and quite clear-headedly in order to cover up the traces of truth. It was the purpose of their history to create among the public the ambient feeling that, bad as things might be at the moment of writing, yet the lesson of history was a lesson of steady improvement.
Oh, boy.
Hollis, page 40. That's very Stuart stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Don, you're next.
So about the end of the 18th century. Is that train out of the station? So by the end of the 18th century, the progressive theory of history had received general acceptance among those who claimed for themselves the prestige of educated people. Hollis, page 40. The consequence, all the ablest youth should never come in contact with any problem that had been a reality since the foundation of Christianity. And yet in this world of unreality, they acquired qualifications which they imagined to entitle them to positions of command in the real world. Thus, Sir Robert Peel was allowed without question to take a leading part in his country's government, and neither he nor anyone else ever suspected for a moment his total misunderstanding of the forces that had gone to shape that country. And the photograph is of Sir Robert Peel, born in 1788, lived through till 1850.
Yeah, I mean, today, I was a history major. I didn't get any of this that we're learning. You know, in order to use it to understand history, understand those
forces.
Wait
a second, I'll get you.
Right?
I'll get you in here. Anne wants to say something.
Okay.
Somebody asked me to read the next slide,
if
I'm mistaken.
Not yet.
Sue?
Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay.
And we were just talking about how what they did back then, they've done in this country with history. You know, our understanding of history.
You know, that's an interesting question. mean, the one place where I see it loud and clear was in slavery. The true history of slavery wasn't really taught when I was going to school. I don't have anything else to say on that. I'm curious.
Right. Yeah. There are sources for American history that have been vaporized from the educational system, but they're still available. You can go out there and get them. And I think right away, let me see. What's his name? Hold on a second.
That's what Stephen has done for us.
Yeah, Stephen has done it with money, but in terms of American history, who's really talking about what it was really like, there's a muckraker from the 1910-1920s who wrote a number of books about the Supreme Court of the United States, about the colonies, the beginning of the colonies, and presents a history very different from what you get in school. You know, he went back to the original sources to write his history, you know. Okay, so Well, you can tell Ann to do the next one.
Oh, Ann, let's see, slide 35.
What was the truth? A clergyman, Saul Rogers, lived in Oxford around 1850 and made a living coaching in the classics of philosophy. In 1860, however, he began serious research into the wages and prices ruling at the various dates in English history. And on the strength of this research, in 1862, he was elected professor of political economy. The statistics which he collected alone show a thick volume, and there is no reason to suspect that the conclusions at which he arrives are generalizations from insufficient data. That's from Christopher Hollis. The truth. Between Henry VII's time and 1850, the population of England multiplied by about five. The productivity of the country had multiplied by about four by 1800, and multiplied by another four and a half between 1800 and 1850, making a total of 18. As a result, the poor ought to have been between three or four times better off. They were, however, considerably worse off. The gentlemen of England, so far from being those leaders of the toward a finer and wider freedom, which the progressive history had represented them to be, were revealed as in the heyday of their power, the trickiest and the most rapacious class ever known. Oops, I'm losing the bottom of the slide.
Among men.
That's all.
Okay.
And that's Hollis, page 46.
Okay.
We got to change the D to an S, so.
Yeah, I see that.
Got it.
Okay.
And that's a picture of his book. He wrote other books. The final one was very, very thick with all of his statistics. And he did it, I don't know if you can see it there, he did it from like 12, oh there it is, History of Agriculture and Prices in England, 1259 all the way through 1793. And he basically said that the peasants back in 1500 had a better life than the working class of England in 1800. They
had
better quality of life and a better life in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. Will, do the next one.
Sure. Slide 36. There's hardly a scholar in all Europe today, 1935, who would not acclaim Roger's greatness. But has anyone who has studied history in textbooks that they dole out at public schools ever heard either him or his thesis?
Well,
has such a one today, a notion that solid scholarship has seriously challenged, let alone refuted, the progressive theory of history. And that's on Hollis on page 48. The poor in Townsend's day were illiterate, therefore there was no necessity to educate them wrong. As a result, there remained among them a strange and divided memory that there had been good times in the past before the dissolution of the monasteries. It came from the fact that it was the coinage of the monastic plate that started the rise in prices. Hollis, page 48. And there is the plunder of the monasteries in the church from 1536 to 1541. And then you've got a picture of a chimney sweep.
Young.
Yeah, he looks like 5 years old, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It has small to get into the chimney.
For 7.
No shoes either. Yeah, you know,
he's getting black lung.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he's getting. From all that soot.
Yeah, it's interesting. He says the poor in Townsend's days were illiterate, so they weren't going to school learning these lies about history, right? So they had, you know, some kind of memory saying, well, no, it was better in the past. You know, we're being told it's better in the future, in the present and the future. And they said, no, it was better in the past, because when they took over the monasteries in England, Henry VIII, all of the gold plate was melted down, and so the money supply increased, right? And so prices increased. And then the poor were worse off. So they had this vague memory, Hollis is saying, that, you know, what's better in the past? Yeah. Let's see. Will, did you do that one?
Yep.
Okay, so Martin, do the next one.
Okay. Well, both the same and Townshend's progressive theory of history. Now, how was it that this perversion of history played into the hands of the masters of the credit system? That was not its original purpose, the purpose for which Townshend and his friends invented it, as has been argued. The revolution of 1688 was essentially the work of gentlemen. The bankers were their very subordinate allies. Yet the most important result of that revolution was the concession of the Bank of England to the Bank of England of the extraordinary privilege of inventing money, a privilege which, as Swift demonstrated, by an inevitable mathematical necessity, has caused the possessors of it to acquire a lien on the entire wealth of the nation to the loss of the gentlemen and everyone else. Hollis, page 49. Down there at the bottom left, we seem to have a ship sailing into harbor. It looks like William III's glorious revolution. And over at the bottom right, we have the signing of a charter of the Bank of England.
Yeah, so this is interesting. You know, this perversion of history in the universities was done to protect the Whigs and the owners of the land. But it was used also to protect the bankers, unfortunately. Don, do the next one.
Okay. Nothing would have been easier than for a system of education to explain to his pupils the nature of this privilege of the bankers. But Townsend's education did not dare tell the story of the founding of the Bank of England unless you also told the true story of the Revolution of 1688. The two were inextricably intertwined. Thus, secure against all dangers of publicity, the power of usury was able to extend its control over the state. Under the system, the gradual extrusion of the landed classes by the moneyed classes was mathematically inevitable. It happened. Hollis, page 50. Now, the picture of the lady in blue and her hunting husband, or whoever it is. Landed gentry is a British social class of landowners who could live entirely off rental income. In 1688, the income of a merchant prince was half of a baronet, little more than an eighth that of a nobleman, and little more than a third that of a bishop. In 1750, some years later, the city of London had a larger commercial income than the rents of the whole House of Lords and the Episcopal bench. It was the Napoleonic Wars which brought the final and complete triumph of the money lenders.
And of course, we all know what happened to the public debt during the Napoleonic Wars. It just exponentially grew.
Yeah.
And therefore, the interest exponentially grew. And therefore, the wealth flowed into the coffers of the bankers.
The banks.
Yeah. Our friend Mr. Rothschild made a fortune.
Right.
Right.
By selling French bonds.
Nathan Rothschild.
Yeah, he did his speculation, right? He learned it from the Dutch. And do the next one.
Okay. The people who stepped into power always called themselves gentlemen. The big landowners, to save themselves, made use of their voices to get a new place, pension or sinecure, something back from the taxers. Sir Charles Pole, Deputy Governor of Bank, 1820, and Governor of the Bank, 1820 to 1822. He's an example of a big landowner. And Montague Norman, 1871 to 1750, was an English banker, best known for his role as Governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1844.
Yeah, these are some more gentlemen, right? Very much gentlemen, right? Oh, boy. Okay, so now we're on the last part. This is an introduction to Adam Smith. And I'm going to read the first one, okay? And then we'll take turns. So Adam Smith, born 1723, died 1790. Adam Smith, who introduced a spirit of sophistry, confusion, and hypocrisy into political economy, even burned his papers on his deathbed for fear lest they should betray his true opinions. And then, I know, it's just incredible. Free trade and laissez-faire, destruction of the national organization, the only power capable of withstanding the offensive of the money system. And of course, we know from history that beginning at day one, it was being undermined constantly by the bankers, since it was the only power that could protect the people. So the first myth falsifies the government's monetary role as minor. So for this 42, why is that? Let's see. Anne, why don't you be Adam Smith, right? And Will, you be Stephen Zarlinger.
Oh, good.
So should Miss Smith start now?
Yeah, start.
nature with those of all makers, that's woolen spectres, and stamp woolen and linen cloth to ascertain the quantity and uniform goodness of those different commodities and the wealth of nations.
Smith would have been intimately familiar with the celebrated 1601 mixed money schemes, which alone improves his mint statement.
For in every country of the world, I believe the avarice and injustice of princes and sovereign states abusing the confidence of their subjects have by degrees diminished the real quantity of metal which had been originally contained in their coins.
Smith contradicts himself, showing the great importance he now places upon the institution of the mint, exaggerating, probably abusing, and essentially condemning all past government control over money.
Plus, he ignored the fact that English history had very little debasement of the coinage, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does everybody remember the 1601 mixed money cases of Elizabeth I?
No.
That was a case because Queen Elizabeth, who ruled the last half of the 16th century, decided that the money of Ireland, over which she ruled, that gold and silver coins should be collected and base metal coins should be used as the money in Ireland. And
yeah.
A merchant in Ireland sent 100 pounds of base metal coin to London to pay for his bill, and the London merchant refused. He wanted gold and silver. It went through the courts to the highest level of courts, and the court confirmed that the Crown of England had the absolute right to decide what the money in her realm was. So that was the importance of that case. Okay, so then the next one, Martin, why don't you be Adam Smith, and Don, you be Stephen Zelenga.
All right. Okay, part 7, falsifies the government's monetary role as miner. Such operations, reduction of metal content in coins, have always proved favorable to the debtor and ruinous to the creditor.
He admits above the great importance of the mint. He's referring to Adam Smith. He slips in the false notion that sovereign states can feel avarice. This is an essential part of the attack on society.
Yeah, and that feeling avarice is back from the prior slide where he talks about, I believe, the avarice and injustice of princes and sovereign states.
Mm-hmm.
The second myth obscures and degrades the concept of money. Martin and Don, why don't you do that one?
Okay. Some obscurity may still appear to remain upon a subject in its own nature extremely abstracted.
Smith shifts responsibility for his obfuscation onto the subject matter.
By the money price of goods, it is to be observed, I understand always, the quantity of pure gold or silver for which they are sold without any regard to the denomination of the coin.
Smith does not refute or acknowledge the existence of more advanced concepts of money.
Including private credit from the Bank of England.
Yeah, things that had existed.
Well, he wrote in 1776. When was the Bank of England created?
Oh, I forget the year.
1694.
Yeah. I knew it was in 1600s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The third myth is the regression to gold and silver by weight. And this is all Stephen Zarlenga. Will, why don't you do this one?
Adam Smith regressed the retrogressed the concept of money backwards to something pure money by weight. He ignored an advanced memory law based on law and the level of unlimited coinage. He had no answer to the great thinkers who showed that money was not merely a commodity. The Bank of England had advanced to abstract paper money 80 years earlier, not in theory, but in practice. Adam Smith regressed to commodity money, not in practice, but in theory. His theory to their practice would cause confusion and create money.
Yeah. Myth number four, studied avoidance of the quantity of money. Don and Ann, why don't you do this? Don, you be Adam Smith, Ann, you be Stephen Zarlinga.
Okay.
And equal quantities of labor at all times and places may be said to be of equal value to the laborer. Labor alone, therefore, never varying in its own value, is alone the ultimate and real standard by which the value of all commodities can at all times and places be estimated and compared. It is their real price. Money is their nominal price only.
Having said money and commodities, he had to explain how gold and silver get their value. He said the value of gold and silver as commodities and as money is determined by the labor involved in producing them, the cost of production. But we know it's not up to a laborer how much he will get paid. He is not free to withhold his labor and to starve his family.
As Adam Smith, I say, labor is its real price, is their real price. Money is their nominal price only.
The only price that buyers and sellers are ever concerned with is expressed in terms of money. The metals were taken from American Indian societies at gunpoint and then mined with slave labor. Did the Indians place equal value on their labor at all times or places? Did it make any difference? Even following Adam Smith's line of reasoning, how would the cost of production affect prices unless it first affected supply, quantity? Smith's avoidance of quantity protected the Bank of England because their additions to the supply of money were causing a drop in the value of money. Smith confused an agent with the value of labor.
The fifth and last one is the myth. Notoriously poor definitions.
Let's go back to that just a little bit. I had this argument today at lunch with a Native American who was arguing for the gold standard. And I said, man, of all people, you shouldn't be arguing for the gold standard. We killed you, we murdered you, we raped you, you stole your money. And he just kind of looked at me kind of puzzled, like, and had the same argument that, how do you put the price on people that are being just used up? This producing this metal that was completely unnecessary.
I'm
going to help him out.
That's good.
Number five, myth, notoriously poor definitions. So, Will and Martin, why don't you do this one?
You want to be Malthus?
I'll be Malthus.
Okay.
Thomas Malthus complained about Smith's obscure concept of labor and value. In no works of political economy is it considered the measure of value. And again, it is quite astonishing that political economists of reputation should include should be included
should, should,
should be included to resort to any kind of illustration, however clumsy and inapplicable, rather than refer to money. Thomas Malthus.
However, when Malthus presented 60 definitions of political economy terms, the definition of money is conspicuously absent.
I think that's okay.
Malthus swallowed Smith's definition of money as gold and silver metal. If economics is ever to become a science, its terminology must be cleanly defined. That's why my work concentrates on the definition and correct identification of the nature of money as the key building unit of economic thought. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And we have the next slide, we have Will Decker's conclusion. The control of money without control from the public leads to corruption, usurpation, and slavery. And we have a postscript here. Martin, why don't you read the postscript?
Okay, postscript. Economics education for 200 years removed the creation of money as a factor in economics. They called it demand for money, implying that money supply is related somehow to our demand for it. They also called it liquidity or savings, implying that it is already created, that it is only created money we are borrowing. They are bold-faced liars. And finally, that is being ferreted out. So it is no surprise that these PhDs have no vocabulary about the function of the money system. They want to think that the destruction comes from deep within us, instead of from these mechanistic institutions and their effects. As BB, New York, 2014.
It's a friend of mine who's... has studied the money system. He's actually doing his PhD on it.
Wow.
Yeah. He's very articulate.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Okay.